Right. Good evening, everyone. My name is Minouche Shafiq, and I'm the director of the London School of Economics. And it's a great pleasure to welcome all of you here today at the school to this evening's event with our honorable speaker, Mario Monti, who will be speaking on the subject, Can National Politics Still Support International Integration? The Case for the EU, with a question mark, I note. This lecture is part of a series organized by the European Institute at the LSE. And at the start of every academic year, we invite a particularly distinguished public figure to launch the start of the series. Professor Mario Monti is currently president of Bocconi University, where he also studied as an undergraduate before going on to do graduate studies at Yale University. He played a key role in building the European single market, spending 10 years as a European commissioner, first for the internal market, financial services and tax policy, and finally on competition, where he arguably built the single market, probably, I would think, the most powerful and popular achievement of the European Union. And that time at the Commission earned him the moniker Super Mario, a title which he occasionally has to share these days with Mario Draghi, but he had it first. He is also incredibly well known for the time he spent as Italy's Prime Minister from 2011 to 2013, where he steered Italy through an incredibly difficult time at the height of the Eurozone crisis. He restored Italy's credibility with financial markets and with fellow European partners, and his reforms of the pension system were particularly crucial for restoring fiscal stability. There are few who understand better how to navigate national politics to support international integration. I've also heard from one of his former students that he was a very good teacher. So I'm sure we're all looking forward to a very engaging and informative talk tonight. Before I invite him to speak to you, I just wanted to remind you that all LSE events are recorded and a podcast will be made available online. And please do turn your phones off to silent. And if you're tweeting, this event's hashtag is hashtag LSESU. And after Professor Monti completes his lecture, there will be questions and answers, and we'll have microphones roving so that we can hear you. So I'd like to invite now Professor Monti to deliver his lecture, Can National Policies Support International Integration?
It's a real emotion and a great pleasure to be here once again. And I'm very grateful to the London School of Economics, to you, Madam Director, to the European Institute for this invitation, and to these two or three students who did show up. It's also a bit daring to have accepted to speak at the London School of Economics, because, this is the London School of Economics and Political Science, and I once was an academic economist. I could hardly call me an economist as you are becoming now, and I've never been a political scientist. But I had to do some things in the course of my life as if I were one or both of these things. So I say this as a sort of caveat, because you're not going to hear from me structured, systemic, scholarly reflections, but rather a series of sometimes impressionistic, other times maybe not completely impressionistic, reflections drawn from experience and the observation of the experience of others. It is particularly interesting and touching, in a sense, to take the floor in London these days. You made reference, Madam Director, to my years spent at the Service of European Integration in Brussels and my responsibilities on the single market. It's a real irony, a very sad one, that the British people decided democratically, totally legitimately, to withdraw themselves from what has been one of the most successful export products of the UK to Europe, the European single market. Because you should remember that the European single market is, more than anything else, the intellectual and political product of the British leadership and, here the irony is compounded, of the conservative British leadership. Because it was when Mrs. Thatcher was Prime Minister and when Lord Caulfield was her designated commissioner for the internal market in the Delors Commission, that what was already a common market really started to become a serious single market. And I always considered myself as a peculiar Italian taking, for some reason, so much interest in opening up markets and building a European single market and keeping it open to competition. I always considered myself as trying to work in the British tradition and under British inspiration. Not that I agreed with all aspects of the policies pursued by the successive British governments, but on this fundamental aspect of the structure of the economy, I really felt very much so. It now comes to my mind, as a matter of fact, that the first timid visit I paid in 1995 to London as European Commissioner for the Internal Market, I asked and easily obtained to be able to meet with Lord Caulfield, who was really not a young man. And I remember a meeting at the representative office of the European Commission here in London. And he gave me some advice on how to deal with Britain, and that will remain confidential. Why do I propose such a strange and roundabout title for this collective conversation? Can national politics still support international integration, the case of the EU? Well, because it has been precisely working on the ground of European integration and working through moments of crisis of European integration that I have come to the conviction that the state, the mood, the condition of national politics is much more important than the surface of European institutions in determining whether European integration moves ahead or goes back. I remember in particular some experiences like the no's to the referenda in on successive occasions in Ireland, in Denmark, in France and the Netherlands in 2005, that was on the referendum on the constitutional, on the draft constitutional treaty. And whenever there was a setback, obviously, for European integration, and a no in a referendum is a setback, you cannot imagine the vigorous process of strenuous self-flagellation that is set in motion among the leadership and the members of the EU institutions, which is a wise and a good moral attitude to keep, but in my view, risked many times of having misjudgments in us on what were the roots of the crisis of the day of European integration. And the self-flagellation immediately brought us collectively in the Commission, but also in the Parliament, etc., to saying we must improve our communication policy, which was, is today, and probably will remain true forever as a need. And what captured my reflection in particular was the view of many of my colleagues, commissioners. I should warn you, I was practically the only one in the Commission to have come to that job without a prior political affiliation and political responsibility in one of the member states. So I was a bit like an entomologist, and observing these real politicians, I was impressed by their saying, oh, our citizens show up little, not so numerous to the European Parliament elections, vote no on this or that referendum. The problem is that they do not recognize themselves in the more vibrant and virulent and sanguine politics that goes on and at the national level. So let's try to make the politics of the EU level as similar as possible to that of the member states. Then people will become passionate, will understand Europe, will even perhaps love Europe. I was never convinced of this. Of course, there were and there are numerous things on which the EU has to improve, and over the years many improvements, but by definition always insufficient, have been introduced. But to me, the opposite was true, namely, the main problems of European integration were generated by dysfunctions of the political process in member states. And then it happened to me to reinforce this conviction when, again, as an outlier, not being a real professional politician, it happened to me that I became a member of the European Council as Prime Minister of Italy for a while. And I was surrounded by the real politicians of Europe. And I was really impressed by their way of behaving. Very skillful. Professional in the political sense of the world. But of course, even though we had to deal with, and in many cases we did so successfully, with huge crises, like you saw many of them, Madam Director, from your slightly more detached and yet deeply involved position in Washington, like the Greek crisis, etc. But that reaffirmed in my perception the idea that, yes, 28, it was at the time, ladies and gentlemen, go to an august table once every 2 months the European Council. They sit down, they take decisions in the interest of Europe, one would imagine. But in most cases and in most instances, they have their mind, their eyes, their ears focused on their domestic political landscape. And it would be therefore a bit unrealistic to believe that they really act in the general interest of Europe. Okay, one can say they may act having in mind their own national interest. That would be already a rather noble version of what sometimes happens, because many times they are understandably conditioned by their party interests or the interest of their government coalition. Some other times, and this borders to me much more with the unacceptable, with their own personal political interest. So, obviously, from this distortion of the prism, you have a flow of decision making at the EU level that may, on occasions, it's not excluded a priori, coincide with the general interest of Europe, but it's not necessarily always the case. Now, against this background, I have been reflecting more and more on why international integration, not just in Europe, has been going through setbacks in the last 10 years at least, maybe even more. It's not just in Europe, because I will come to Europe in a moment, but internationally, the peak days of international integration are over. If you look at the WTO figures in terms of trade agreements, et cetera, the peak is over. If you look at the references to the national interest in the actual economic or industrial policy decisions of countries, and not only in Europe, that is more and more a reflex to take that into account. Of course, last year we were all watching with acute attention and a lot of concern to the Brexit debate in this country. But if we just for a second looked elsewhere, we were seeing that, for example, in the US, the two main candidates for the presidential election had only one thing in common, and that was the fact of being not really warm on international trade or international openness. And then one of them eventually won and started with the not so obvious statement, America first, from which I believe we should draw a couple of point of reflections. One, of course, if every leader in every country, as the president says would be appropriate, pursues the national interest, well, there may be a fallacy of composition sometimes, perhaps ending in wars. But the other thing which I think is helpful for us in Europe is that he said America first, not Pennsylvania first or Idaho first. And so it would be a real good progress in Europe if we had our nationally minded leaders say Europe first. At any rate, why is it that something inherent in the political process has over time eroded the support for international integration? I think it has to do with several factors, but in particular with the increasing short-termism of the political process, importance of being elected, the importance of being re-elected. But now the election, even if it takes place in 1 year, is the remote future. But you have, when you are in Brussels and take part in the European Council in a collective pro-European decision-making, supposedly, you have in mind the public opinion polls in your country next week, which may determine your strength in the government coalition, for example. So this acute short-termism, which makes it less and less politically viable to invest in the future. So this leads, it's not only that, but it is the short-termism, not only in the sense of the time horizon, but also in the sense of the framework of the debate, of the political discourse. The 140 characters of a tweet do not necessarily facilitate deep reflection bent on the long term, or the 10 seconds TV spot through which you may win or lose elections. And obviously, this introduces a bias, in my view, in favor of the nationalist and populist slogans, which can be pronounced in 5 or 10 seconds, whereas if you have to counter your opponent who says, we have a lot of youth unemployment, let's close our borders to foreign products, apparently seductive at first sight, but if you want to show that, yes, but on the face of it, if you look at economic history, you find that countries which close themselves then afterwards experience declines, and what would be the reaction of the others to protectionist measures, it's at least 2 minutes if you are an excellent communicator and you have lost. So, to use an architectural image, I consider the national leaders of the past going to Brussels as bringing each time a brick for the European construction, in the awareness, in the belief at least, that by and large a strengthening of that construction was also in their national interest. More recently, each time they go, they desperately try to take a brick from the construction and to magically transform it into a powder from which they hope to extract domestic political consensus. So it's not very easy to imagine that the construction can go on. So this was the mood in which I personally started to address this issue and to give speeches and to write articles on the likely process of European disintegration. Then came the decision of my one-time friend and colleague David Cameron, a wonderful personality and a very constructive member of the European Council, to hold a referendum. With what happened afterwards. Now, What he did in that, I think we can now see that clearly and lucidly, was only to do the same game of the average other national leader, only to the utmost degree. Because the decision to call that referendum, totally legitimate, was not probably done in the general interest of Europe. Was it in the national interest of the UK? Many people doubted before and doubt even more now. Was it at least in the general interest of the Conservative Party? No. Not quite. There is by now the shared diagnosis that was done. It was a brave move, the objective of which was to try and reinforce Mr. Cameron's position in the control of that rather difficult party on European matters. Now, it was therefore like a laboratory experiment. And once Brexit was decided by the British electors, one could expect and fear, so did I for a while, a contagion effect to spread around most European countries. And I was really concerned until the end of last year, more or less. Now, and I will say a word on yesterday's elections in Germany, in spite of that, I think that overall we can say that the contagion effect out of Brexit has not materialized, and if anything, an antibody effect has been developing. Why? Well, already 72 hours after the Brexit vote, the Spaniards were called to their national political elections. Their populist nationalist party did much less well than expected, and many observers attribute this to the immediate sense of disarray that we all got from the UK in the hours following the result of the Brexit referendum, where not only those who had wanted the referendum maintaining they were in favor of staying in the Union, but also those who won the referendum because they wanted to exit, and everybody else, like in a domino effect, there was no more any political leader in the UK in a matter of a few hours that had not resigned for different reasons. And all of a sudden, but very quickly, it was discovered that there wasn't much of a deep analysis on what the consequences would be, let alone on how to embark in a negotiation. And so pretty soon the others felt that it would have been a bit hazardous to go down to the same in the same road. So the fact remains that where there were elections, the results were more in favor of European integration than it was expected. That was, after Spain, the case of the Austrian presidential elections on December the 4th of last year. I will say a word on whether or not what happened in Italy on that same day, the 4th of December, that is the negative result in the constitutional referendum can be inscribed on or not in the antidote. I know that the students of LSE were sharply divided, those taking an interest in Italian affairs about what to hope for. Well, I will simply say that in my view, it wasn't true at all that that was going to be a defining moment in the case of a no, with the risk that the financial markets would be upset. And I was always convinced before and after the event, so the negative result in the referendum, that it would have been very, very inappropriate to draw, as many did outside Italy, the conclusion that on the 4th of December of last year in Austria the populists were defeated, whereas they were the winners in Italy, as if the nationalists, the anti-Europeans, and the populists had won, and as if the no position in the referendum were driven by them. I, for one, voted no, and I do not believe that I have become anti-European, populist, and nationalist for that. And the financial markets had this no, and they couldn't care less in terms of impact. So I see also Italy as affected in that case by many other considerations, but difficult to inscribe in a populist or anti-populist trend. Then came the Netherlands in March, where Mr. Wilders did have an impressive result, but less impressive than was generally believed to be the case. Then, of course, came the French election, which were notable because of the head-on position and hands-on position taken by candidate Emmanuel Macron, challenging openly Marine Le Pen and her party on the European positions. And there we had somebody who was elected with a strong pro-EU platform. What else? Then we came to the German elections, and then we will have, I believe, on the 18th of October, the Austrian parliament elections. Then one day I promise you that also Italians will go to vote. Maybe in the Q&A period, if somebody has this insane interest, we could chat a bit on that. And then of course we will move towards the European elections in 2019. Now, what we saw has been over this cycle that the electors have become more less instinctively reluctant to the EU than many of us thought likely. But that is for the places where there have been elections. But if we look at the public opinion polls, Eurobarometers, Bertelsmann, etc., we see that the public opinion at large, as measured by these polls, has also been taken by an antibody effect more than by a contagion effect. Because in all member states, with one exception, Italy, post-Brexit vote, the degree of favor for the euro, the European Union, has actually increased, not declined. And as to the top level, so I spoke of the electorate, I spoke of the public opinion at large, and at the level of the governments and the heads of the governments, watching from outside, I have the impression that they have become more cautious in playing with the EU for purely domestic political purposes, because the experience of David Cameron was, of course, very close to them and has been observed with a lot of consequences drawn. This does not allow us to say, in my view, that now, all of a sudden, after this exciting year that our British friends granted to us, now national politics can, yes, of course, again, fully support international integration in the EU and elsewhere, far from it, far from it. But I think that at least there has been, I couldn't say a learning process, otherwise I would not be neutral, but at any rate you know that I'm not neutral on European affairs. There has been a capacity to reflect and to react on phenomena, which I think is a very positive and encouraging signal. Particularly at a time when the European Union, or what will remain of it, has completely changed its positioning in the world, not so much because it is changing or it has changed, but because everything else around it is changing, and we have a more, let's say, assertive Russia and Turkey than we used to have. We have a puzzling island across the English Channel with whom we have some difficulties in negotiating and even greater difficulties in understanding what its ultimate identity will be. And we have across the Atlantic somebody who, by the way, this also is interesting. You may remember that once he took office, President Trump set out rather vigorously with the idea of favoring some disintegration of the European Union. You may remember his tactful invitations to Mr. Farage, to Mr. Orban, some language that he used, and it appeared that he wanted to send to Brussels a professor who said, well, previously, under a president many years ago, I was involved in the deconstruction of the Soviet Union. That was at the time of President Reagan, who, of course, with the cooperation of the Europeans, acted a lot to disintegrate the Soviet Union. Whether we should be happy or not of the final outcome, it's open to historians, but that was the case. And that brave gentleman was saying, now it's time to have another operation of this sort, this time trying to disintegrate the European Union. Now, so far, it does not seem to have been the case that the attitude of President Trump has been successful in this respect. And if one were to be cynical, even in a context of, this is at least my case, continuing, never-ending, profound admiration for the US and their people and their traditions, one could ask the questions, but is he proceeding faster in disintegrating the EU or in disintegrating the United States? Because I'm not joking. If you consider the reemergence of ethnic identities in a rather vigorous and violent way, the all of a sudden problem that citizens have with monuments and statues of the past, the almost complete separation that has now occurred between the thinking of the business community and the thinking of the administration, which had never occurred before, the signing up of many states of the United States for positions in the area of climate change, which are opposite to the ones maintained now by the Washington administration, one can really ask the question. At any rate, it's really a very interesting, and here I am in pure impressionism, as you will have understood, a very interesting picture of the elements which are playing currently in favor of, again, a national support of international integration or in the opposite direction. I will conclude with a word on, with two words. One on the Anglo-Saxons. I've always thought and spoken with profound convinced reverence and deference of the Anglo-Saxons in the sense, basically, of the UK and the US. And I have seen the developments in many of our continental European countries over the last several decades as a process of, as an effort to take on to follow some of the elements of success of the Anglo-Saxon countries in bringing rationality to public policy decision making. As an economist, I've always been impressed, for example, by the seamless process of ideas. Well, first of all, they have in the US and very much so in the UK the best universities in the world, and of course we are in one of them. But also the way in which the analysis, the theory, the empirical work through think tanks has been transfused into the process of decision making by the high public administration, by the politicians in parliament, in government, in the UK and in the US, has been a reason for constant admiration by many, many of us, and I think we have all made an effort to come closer to that. And then, but this is really for the historians, unless it is dismissed prima facie, what happened in 2016? Is it possible that as a coincidence in the same historical moment, the two bastions of Anglo-Saxon strength turn the page and give at least to us modest continental European observers the impression of them imitating us in our worst aspects, but doing remarkably better than us. And if I take the UK, all of a sudden we saw the most skillful and shrewd and competent administration, public administration that there is in Europe, with a few others, to seem to be completely lost. The link between the administration and the political decision makers to become totally confused. The link between the business community, manufacturing, and the financial community even, and the political decision makers, which had always been a great strength of this country in shaping the European policies, disappeared. In the US, I will not well, I was visiting with my family parts of the US in August, and the disrespectful observation came to my mind, visiting the beautiful, impressive Monument Valley, that at least they have a huge space where they can put all the statues that will be recused in this historical reconsideration. And apologize for this light tonality, but these problems, I think, are very shocking and very serious. So, and is it possible that all of a sudden our heavy not sufficiently modernized continental Europe becomes an island of an island of rationality? This cannot be, but one could even think that this is happening, and you have the president of France taking on some world leadership in the assertion of certain values. You have the Chancellor of Germany in dialogue with, of all possible things, the President of the People's Republic of China on how to best promote free trade and multilateralism. I am disconcerted. I think we should not now fall victims of an illusion, and continental Europe has so many problems, and the absence of the UK from that table will aggravate some of these problems. But still, in terms of the relationship between national politics and the positioning of countries in international integration, I think you, who are well-equipped with all the analytical tools of economics and political science, should give us the answers. Very, very last word on Germany. It's a very difficult case to analyze. I believe that the impressive result of the AfD, which should not lead us to forget the very impressive result of a lady who has been, probably will become chancellor for the fourth time, a real anchor of stability in Europe, but how to assess from the point of view of the consequences on the process of European integration this development in German national politics. Well, my first impression is that there are some aspects in which the AfD will side with, will compound their effects with the other nationalists and populists that we have around Europe. That is on the migration, asylum, and these things, and very dangerously on the localism to the extreme, etc. But there is another aspect in which, in my view, we are going to see a powerful clash between some nationalists, the German ones, and some others, in particular those of southern countries. And the dividing line is the euro. Why? Because the euro is at the origin of the foundation of AFD. There were some old, very conservative professors in Germany, those who bring complaints to the Constitutional Court in Germany, to the European Court of Justice in Luxembourg against the euro, the ECB, etc. They love the currency that is no longer there, the Deutsche Mark. They were against the creation of the euro. But in that, they were representative of a much wider German audience. For example, the followers of Madame Le Pen in France hardly remember, probably they were not born, they don't know, that it has never been Germany who wanted the single currency, the euro. It was France, and it was Italy. It was those countries who did not want a reunified Germany to be the exclusive country, the only country with a strong currency. But for the Germans, it was very hard to digest. And one predecessor of Chancellor Merkel, Helmut Kohl, lost the elections in 1998 because his opponent, Gerhard Schröder, was at the time against the euro, and he caught this popular sentiment. But as a real leader, Chancellor Kohl lost power but entered into European history because the euro was eventually adopted. Like, maybe, might have happened to Chancellor Merkel if she had lost this election, because that would most probably have been the result of her leadership on the refugees 1 year, 2 years ago, that was way ahead of what the sensitivity in her country could accept. But I think it's good for Europe that she has not lost this one. At any rate, there will be a positioning when it comes to the euro and the policies surrounding the euro. For example, I would not expect the AFD to be in favor, or even the liberals, if they enter the coalition, to be strong supporters of Emmanuel Macron's and Italian ideas on the finance minister for the eurozone or the fiscal capacity for the eurozone, or for a great dilution of the degree of fiscal discipline in Europe. So, and this will be interesting to follow, but to AFD, the euro has been and is a dangerous vehicle for pollution by the others. Of course, they don't know that it was not Greece, but it was Germany and France that first violated the Stability Pact in 2003. But they believe that they are poisoned by the southerners through the euro. But of course, the populists and the nationalists in Greece, in Italy, in Spain, in France, are convinced that the euro is the Machiavellian instrument through which Germany wanted and is successfully pursuing a policy of domination and exploitation over the rest of Europe. So we may see there a clash among nationalists and populists, which we should fear, but I think if the nationalists were to win everywhere, first they would behave as friends, because the common enemy, the EU, Brussels, the Eurocrats, would have been defeated. But once finished that purification of Europe, they would turn their flags against each other, as it has always been in the history of Europe, except for this curious, exceptional period of 70 and more years of peace due to the European integration, which I think we have the duty to follow with great attention and care, starting at its roots, that is, the developments in national politics. Thank you very much for your attention.
Well, thank you for that wonderful kind of analysis and explanation of the current turmoil in all of our political lives. I'll open it up for questions now. We've got stewards with mics. Please introduce yourself, and I think we'll take groups of three questions at a time. And maybe while you're thinking of your questions, I'll start with one myself, if I may. You talked about the decline in the Anglo-Saxon tradition of rationality in 2016 and the demise of that and what is behind it. And I suspect a part of it is around the legacy of the financial crisis and the sense that the losers from globalization and integration weren't looked after enough by those advocating greater integration. And I wonder, some people now, people like, say, Larry Summers, for example, are arguing that we need what he calls responsible nationalism, that those who are in policymaking roles need to take greater account, for example, in negotiating a trade deal to make sure that there's sufficient adjustment mechanisms for those workers likely to suffer as a result of liberalization, or before advocating more labor mobility or having higher levels of immigration, to take into account whether the social infrastructure is there to absorb higher levels of immigration. So this kind of accept that the nationalists have a point, but try and continue integration with a more responsible face. Do you think that's a legitimate argument, that somehow the integrationists got ahead of the losers in some sense?
May I now?
Yes, please.
I definitely believe so. And I believe in particular that, this is the case to me as far as global integration is concerned and as far as European integration is concerned. And that, to me, is not just the product of the financial crisis, but came before even, because if we look, for example, at the no vote in France in 2005, that is before the financial and economic and social crisis, and yet you will remember the syndrome against the Polish plumber. It was the rejection of integration at the social level, associated with fears which were probably largely unjustified, but that was there. And I am convinced, like Larry Summers, that it has been irresponsible, not only from the point of view of the general interest, but also from the point of view of the interest of pursuing integration and globalization, not to take care of the social consequences. For example, and this is the one point on which I disagreed when I was in office in Brussels with Blair and then Brown, I believe that if we want the single market to go ahead, to become deeper, to involve aspects like the digital or the professions or energy that are not yet really single, we cannot expect that to come simply through conviction. Because people have come to associate with the European single market a bias against labor and in favor of capital, which is true, because if you have in a system of integrated markets, mobility of goods, services, people, mobility of everything, then if you stick to tax competition because you don't want to harmonize or to make some progress at least on some tax coordination, then the consequence, and this can be shown analytically and can be seen empirically, the consequence is that the tax competition does not have the good consequence that the pro-market people would like to see, namely that it destroys a cartel of the states and all countries are forced to bring tax pressure down. It may have that in part as an effect, but it has above all the effect of distorting the structure of taxation, because tax competition will benefit most to those tax bases which are more mobile, like capital, like selecting the location of your company, whereas labor, and in particular unskilled labor, who doesn't have mobility until it makes the drastic decision of migrating, is left there under the increasing tax pressure, because member states have to compensate the loss of revenue due to this competition with higher taxation on labor. And to some extent I see the result of Brexit as a vindication against the prevailing British doctrine that the single market, forget the people component, but the single market has virtues of itself that does not need accompanying policies to entice the support of people for the single market. So I totally agree with Larry Summers. I wouldn't call it responsible nationalism. I would call it responsible integration, responsible globalization, not nationalism.
Okay. Let me open it to the floor. I'll start. Why don't I start at the top? There's two gentlemen there, and there's one here. And if you could introduce yourself.
My name is Marco. I'm a student here at LSE. I'm from Italy. And first of all, I would like to thank you very much for coming. It's been an excellent talk. I really enjoyed it. So I just wanted to ask, there has been talk of a more profound implementation of the idea of a multi-state Europe, where different nations where different treatment will be reserved for different nations according to their gross domestic product or their political situation. So in your opinion, do you think that this will facilitate international integration, especially among those Eastern European countries such as Hungary or Poland, which have turned out to be a bit more receptive in the past, and also will this type of integration also help take the populist threat in even more advanced economies such as Italy or Germany or France, as we have seen?
Okay. Gentleman next to him, yes, right there.
Carlo Mancherelli, LSE European Institute. Also, thank you for sharing your thoughts. So my question relates to this one. So one of the questions that we have is that, of course, now that the British claim against further integration have been dismissed by the referendum, the outcome of the referendum, probably the EU should offer an alternative model of integration.
Could you speak a bit louder?
Sorry, yes. So the EU should provide an alternative model of integration now that the the claims of against integration have been dismissed with the outcome of the referendum, particularly for countries such as Poland, indeed Sweden and Norway. Do you think that this model of further integration could take the shape of what has been envisaged by the Five President report? So are you in favor of the project devised by the Five President report at all?
Okay. And then one here, and then I'll return to Professor Monti.
Thanks. Hi, my name is Sebastian Wiesner. I'm also in the LSE European Institute. It's also a question on Monti's view of Europe. And actually, I will allow myself to answer it because I asked you that question also last time you came to.
I remember.
Even if you didn't, I wouldn't be mad. back then, you told us that more or less that multi-speed Europe is already a reality and you shouldn't be afraid of it. But I wonder maybe if your thinking has changed. Just the other week we had the State of the Union speech by Jean-Claude Juncker, who was really very dismissive of that idea and rather claiming that we should have a one-speed Europe where all members join the Euro, who have a stronger commission, etc. So I guess I'll just echo the questions in the sense that in a post-Brexit world, should, according to you, should the EU be a one-speed or a multi-speed?
Okay. All right. Three very similar questions. So,
shall I?
Yes, please.
Yes, as I said on the last occasion I came here, but of course N minus one will not remember. Multi-speed Europe is there already, has been there since the beginning, and I believe that it is not necessarily harmful. I believe that it is a pragmatic, I would have said that traditionally an Anglo-Saxon way of proceeding. We have Schengen, we have the single currency, not for everybody. Now, there are cases, though, where I believe that multi-speed Europe can resemble a suicide. And for example, taking again the case of tax competition or tax coordination, if some countries want to have the greater emotion of seeing among themselves a higher degree of integration and therefore adopt, for example, a common tax rate on corporate taxation, that is indeed a step forward in their integration, but is at the same time a gift to those outside of that circle of integration, to the extent that the common rate of taxation adopted by the ones in would be higher than the other ones. So there are cases. It was just after the decision of the Competition Commissioner Margaret Vestager last year on the Apple case, which was, by the way, not at all a fine, as many people believed. In the state aid area, the Commission does not fine. In that case, the Commission ordered the government of Ireland to ask Apple to give it, not to the coffers of the EU, 13 billion euros of unpaid taxes. So this area of taxation is one where I come back to the point. Last year, there was this decision on Apple and Ireland, and the British Prime Minister, I think it was already Theresa May, said, come to the UK, big multinationals, don't go to Ireland. If you come to the UK, you will not be exposed to these risks. because we will no longer be under the taxation policy of the EU or the state aid rules of the EU, but of course we will still be in the single market, and therefore, so that if the EU were to accept this, it would be a dangerous form. On, the fact that Mr. Juncker, as President of the Commission, has a bias in favor of not multi-speed but all maximum speed, if possible, integration is understandable. I think he does his institutional job, and it is. And he also has the duty to apply the law, to enforce the law, and under the European law, it was only UK, under the treaties, it was only the UK and Denmark, if I remember well, who had an opt-out. As to the five present reports, I think that I would slightly differ from them. In particular, they see very much the institutional progress, like the finance minister for the EU, etc. I believe if we had time to discuss this topic, which we don't, I believe that now it's more urgent to proceed to some substantive policy changes. For example, under a Macron-Merkel initiative with others, it would be more important to come to an agreement that some change is introduced into the Stability Pact to favor public investments and get rid of all the array of flexibilities that pollute the notion of fiscal discipline, rather than trying to set up now a finance minister.
Okay, I'm going to open it up here. One back there, one here, and one here. Maybe hold it closer. Maybe I'll turn to, why don't you ask your question and then we'll get the mic to you.
Could those who take the floor stand, please, so that I... okay, thank you.
Thank you for your lecture. My name is Federico, and I am a master's student at the European Institute. As a fellow Italian, my question is rather predictable. What is your view on the upcoming national election, and what impact do you think they could potentially have on the country's position on European and further international cooperation, if at all?
Okay, there was one here. Yeah, maybe just, and then I'll come back to you in the back.
Hi, my name is Maureen, and I'm a student here at LSE, and I wanted to ask, what do you think about the rise of so-called illiberal democracies in the EU, such as Hungary and Poland? Like, they don't explicitly want to leave the EU, but they're very hostile to EU values. So what do you think the implications of that are
for
the EU going forward? Okay, and in the back. Maybe, there we are. Lisa Alan, I just wanted to ask about what you think the role of the media has been, which is somewhat predictable, so it's kind of pressing, but about showing this as a national politics versus international integration. And the way that the media has played a role in certainly prompting identity politics, so people feel like they have to belong to either a country or the European Union. And when you think that what the media can do to, I suppose, take a share of that blame and make it better going forward.
Okay, thank you.
On the media, I don't have enough competence, but I believe this is an absolutely central issue. I don't believe that we can regulate the contents of the media if we don't want to be listed with Hungary and Poland under the previous question. But I believe that the social media have indeed brought to the exasperation, to the extremes. Many have shown this effect of polarizing the views, of making the notion of truth highly volatile, if not no longer existent. But even without these phenomena, as I said earlier on, the style of the debate in the media today is such as to introduce a bias of contents as to the different political positions. I cannot be more constructive, I'm sorry, but certainly this is a big problem. On the illiberal democracies, I think that, I was against, although I was a modest commissioner, so it was not for me to judge what President Chirac said or wanted to do when Austrian Chancellor Schüssel introduced Mr. Haider in the government. You remember the nationalist and populist leader, one of the earliest ones. France had the intention to activate Article 7 of the treaty, bringing to expulsion. Other countries moderated Chirac, and I think it was well to do so. But because one needs to judge on the actual behavior, not on the presumption. I've not followed the Hungarian and the Polish situation closely, but it seems to me that the case could be made that there is behavior that puts in question the respect of the division of power and of the principles of liberal democracies. I think the EU, if there were cases like that, it's not for me to judge whether they incur now in this situation or not, should not hesitate and should consider also temporary suspensions, sanctions, expulsions, extrema ratio, because this is a fundamental aspect of our coexistence. On the Italian elections, from my biased pro-European perspective, I think it was an excellent idea not to accede to the pressures to have early elections just after the result of the referendum, like early elections in January, February, or March of 2017. Why I think that, well, first of all, because I think that normally parliaments should last until their last day. But also, if Italy had elections at that point, I believe that I'm biased here, I declare that the nationalists and the populist movements would have found themselves in a stronger position than they will be in by the day next February or March when there are the normal elections. Why? Because we hadn't seen yet this rather virtuous net of this AfD result in Germany circle of regaining confidence in the process of European integration. So I believe that especially if with all the difficulties that Mrs. Merkel will face in forming a new coalition and a new government, but if the German-Franco duo produces a proposal of revamping European integration that is, of course, open and attractive to others, the public opinion in Italy by then will value the proposal to leave the euro or even to leave the EU as very risky, problematic, and unjustified, more than it would have been the case months ago. Of course, I know that also in the financial markets, but also in the diplomatic and political world, there are concerns because of the very good performance in the polls of two of these political parties, the Northern League and the Five Star Movement. As far as the EU is concerned, I must say that they have put recently a lot of water in their wine of anti-EU, probably because they have seen that in other countries that was not necessarily a recipe for success, maybe also because as the elections approach, they take also the temperature with the business community in Italy, and they can probably see what problematic consequences would be there if Italy were to decide to reduce its degree of integration in the EU. Also an element of reassurance concerning the prospects after the elections is that it seems very difficult that, it seems very likely that there will be a hung parliament. I know that in some countries, particularly in this one, a hung parliament is an awful event and outcome. I'm not sure that this is a proposition of general validity. Why? Because a hung parliament forces that country to build a broader coalition. A broader coalition at difficult times like the present ones for all countries, which need reforms to adjust to globalization, etc. A broader coalition is, in my view, better equipped to bear the high political cost of reforms than what traditionally we consider a stronger political system with a center-left or a center-right clear majority. If I can bring the modest experience of my government, that was a hung parliament because the majority of Prime Minister Berlusconi in 2011 evaporated. He lost the majority. He wasn't able to take any incisive measure, let alone the pension reform, which was required by all means in those days, and so he resigned. So the parliament became hung. There were not new elections at the time, but there was no longer a majority. I was asked to come in, and it would have been impossible to extract from the Italian parliament, from the Italian political system, bold measures without a hung parliament and without what was in fact a grand coalition, because we had two main components in the majority through which the different proposals of the government were approved in Parliament, and the unwilling partners of this exposed very harmonious coalition in the measures that it took were Mr. Berlusconi and Mr. Bersani. So two persons who hadn't been speaking to each other for years. So it was cumbersome to run that majority because I had to duplicate the meetings because I could not call them to a majority meeting. But it worked in terms of taking the measures. And and I think it can be formalized in a model because reforms bring unpopularity. Unpopularity brings political cost for the parties who support the reform. But what matters, this was my argument to those gentlemen who were like this, hearing this argument, Berlusconi and Bersani, I said, what should matter to you is not the political cost that you, Mr. Bersani, leader of the left, will unquestionably have to bear because of the pension reform. What matters, what should matter to you in view of the next elections is that gross political cost to you relative to your constituencies minus the political cost that I will have to impose to the center-right with some wealth tax, much stronger instruments against tax evasion, etc. They too are going to lose votes because of these unpopular measures to them. Mm-hmm. But what matters to each of you is your net political cost. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure they fully understood, but they behaved as they did.
Okay, well, I think that's a wonderful note to end on, how the real politics of managing economic reforms. Thank you, Mario Monti, for being for your defense of rationality in policymaking, for your case for responsible internationalism, for being a pragmatist in the European political sphere, and for the wisdom of true experience in economic reforms. I think you deserve it.